Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Deborah Lavoie and Drill Baby Still to introduce today's show with two views of energy and our unending need for it, despite the costs. Dar Jamail joins us again from New Orleans with an update from the spill zone. And Golden Gate Audubon's conservation director, Mike Lyons, talks to us about the reality behind wind energy. Even as the ongoing disaster in the Gulf turns into more and more of a catastrophe, there seems to be less about it reported in the mainstream media, and more draconian stipulations governing the reporting that the media there can present. Last week, independent journalist Dar Jamail joined us from New Orleans, and you can listen to that report archived on RaisingSandRadio.org. Dar Jamail is with us again this week to do an update on what is happening in the Gulf.
Tomorrow we'll have been here for 2 weeks, and we've been really getting out and about quite a bit. We spent yesterday down in Barataria, which is a small town about an hour's drive south of New Orleans, and it's also a shrimping and commercial fishing and charter fishing village. Basically, everyone down there is deeply involved in the fishing industry in one form or another. Kind of a small collection of houses along canals that are all attached to bayous that lead out south into the marsh and then into some of the bigger bays where a lot of the inland fishing is flooded. And we went down there and spent time with a woman named Tracy Coons, who is the executive director of Louisiana Bayou Keeper, basically an NGO that tasks itself with trying to keep the area clean and free of pollutants and educating people on the importance of it. And she's also a commercial shrimper, as is her husband. And we spent the day with them, and it was a rather shocking experience, one which we're still recovering from, because down in that area, I mean, this is one of the hardest hit inland bay of the Louisiana southeast coast so far. It was about the third place that the oil reached. It's been there a long time, and it keeps coming in very large quantities. And we were down there less than 2 hours, and I found my eyes burning. I was short of breath. You could smell oil and chemical smell in the air, and it was very disturbing. And then the longer we stayed, the more horrific it became. We had some of our neighbors come by. Also, a charter fisherman came by. Look, we had Thursday night. I went outside to take my dog out and found that crabs were literally crawling out of the canal onto land. And as he said, it's because he fears that the dispersant and oil mix is sucking oxygen out of the water and polluting it so heavily that literally marine wildlife is trying to flee the water. And literally, we'll be posting this soon, but I have a video that he gave me that he filmed of the crabs literally fleeing the water because they couldn't breathe, and of course the next morning they were all dead.
Wow. How are people doing down there? I mean, if you were there for such a short time, what's going on with people that are residents?
Well, needless to say, that's even worse than what we experienced. Tracy, for example, the whole time we were hanging out, was, you know, several times complaining about, hey, I have this headache that I just can't seem to shake. I'm feeling nauseous. A couple times she felt very nauseous and just about had to excuse herself to the bathroom. Nobody's really sleeping well. People are complaining often of shortness of breath. And another thing that I'll be posting soon for people who haven't seen it yet, but the medical listing of the effects of the dispersants, and particularly the dispersants mixed with oil, is rather shocking. It's basically a long, morbid laundry list of extremely detrimental effects that these things have on the human body. Everything I just described, headaches, shortness of breath, to long-term cellular damage, to genetic malformations. I mean, it's a very long, horrific list. And unfortunately, what people are experiencing down there, the people are getting very, very sick. Another thing I should mention, a few days ago I went and saw Dr. Ricky Ott, who is a marine toxicologist and Exxon Valdez survivor. She gave a talk at a public forum at the City Hall over in Chalmette, which is basically the other side of New Orleans from where I am now. And she's an expert on the situation, and she basically said, look, what needs to happen is the Gulf Coast residents need to be evacuated, and BP needs to pay for it, and then they need to compensate these people for everything that they're going to be losing, that if we're really dealing with this situation, which she refers to as a hazardous material spill, as it is, if we go by the book, then it needs to be dealt with in that fashion, and it is that big of an emergency.
And BP, what do they say to this?
Well, BP consistently downplays the any detrimental effects of either the oil or the dispersants or the mix of these two chemicals. And just to reiterate what a lot of people have probably already heard, you know, they're using two different types of Corexit dispersants, and both of these are banned in the UK. They're so toxic and detrimental that that the government of Great Britain understands this, and they're not allowed to use this over there. But over here, our so-called Environmental Protection Agency and our so-called Coast Guard have long since given BP a pass on the dispersants, and even when they've tried to limit the amount of dispersants that they're spraying on the oil, both down at the wellhead at the bottom of the Gulf, as well as using planes and helicopters to spray it from the top, and in some instances even spraying it from boats, when the EPA and Coast Guard tried to limit the amount they could use, of course BP is ignoring the limits they've put on. And in fact, it's just come out that the Coast Guard's even tried, you know, when they basically sent BP documentation saying, well, the limit that we told you before that we wanted you to have as a maximum amount you could use per day, we're actually going to go ahead and increase that for you. So it's just yet another instance of government complicity in BP's really criminal behavior of using extremely dangerous chemicals on a mass scale out in the Gulf as well as up even in the inland bays, as I saw yesterday. Mm.
Dar, last week when we talked, you mentioned that there seemed to be some kind of media was not getting in and out. Is that continuing?
It's worsening. Since last time we talked, the Coast Guard came out and announced this insane rule that any media caught within a 60-foot perimeter of booming operations or operations vessels working on the response, if we're caught within 60 feet of that, then we're subject to a $40,000 fine and a Class D felony, which is a federal offense, which could land us anywhere between 1 and 5 years in jail. So it's gotten worse. People are complaining about this. It's not doing any good. It's really draconian. This is a situation, Susan, where it's so intense, where every day since I've been here, and I was reading everything I could get my hands on before I came, but even since we've been here, every day we come on something that really underscores how bad, how catastrophic this situation really is, and it's getting worse by the day.
And it's actually not something that we're reading in the press. I always look at the New York Times every morning just to see what the latest word is to the people, and the people are not getting this word, that's for sure.
Well, and there's so much more. I mean, there's really so much more. I'm having trouble even just keeping up with everything that we're coming across and what people are telling us. And the fact is that, you know, this is a disaster so big that even seafood in the Gulf, I think one of the most immediate ways this becomes apparent is, you know, we're not going to be having any more fresh, edible, safe seafood from the Gulf. We talk about shrimp and fish and oysters and everything that comes out. I mean, we're already seeing the biggest oyster houses in New Orleans that are basically not selling oysters anymore. Biggest distribution area in the city where they're shucked and then distributed to restaurants and stores around New Orleans, they're going out of business. So we're already seeing immediate impacts here in entire livelihoods. I mean, we look at these fishing communities along the southeast coast of Louisiana, and I was talking with a guy yesterday named Clint Guidry. He's a third-generation shrimper here, and he's looking at his entire livelihood and heritage being wiped out, possibly permanently.
Hmm. Well, what do you do now? What are the plans for the next few days?
Well, we're here for at least a couple of more weeks, and we're going to probably extend it because the bigger we deep, the more we're finding that needs to be reported. But just the next couple of days, tomorrow we have plans to actually fly out in a seaplane out to what is now referred to as the source, the place where the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded and sank, and the place where, which is of course directly atop 5,000 feet above on the surface where the oil is gushing as we speak uncontrolled into the Gulf of Mexico. And it's where they have the relief rig set up where they're trying to drill the relief wells, and they're skimming ships and burning operations where they're burning the oil on the surface. So we're going to fly out there tomorrow and try to take photos and video. And then the next day we're going out in a boat from Venice into some of the most oil-affected areas on the coast of southeast Louisiana. So it should be a very interesting and challenging and I'm sure appalling next couple of days.
Dar, have you heard anything about this cap? The papers are saying that there's a cap that's supposed to be accomplished by the end of this weekend.
Right. That's the word now that they'd taken off this previous cap on it, which was basically a siphoning device that they put on it. It doesn't actually stop the flow of oil, but it gives them a little bit of control that they can then siphon some of it up onto nearby ships and on the surface. And they've taken that off. It's off right now as we speak, so there's nothing on what's flowing into the Gulf. And then they're going to try to put on a tighter cap that it gives them a bit more control and supposedly is going to allow them to contain more of the oil. This won't stop it by any stretch of the imagination, but theoretically it's going to allow them to at least keep some more of it from gushing directly into the Gulf. But again, all the insiders I'm talking with within the oil industry are saying, look, this is just a farce. This isn't really going to change much. And then this talk of a relief well being so far ahead of schedule and that they may actually have this thing actually plugged by the end of the month. All the insiders I'm talking with are basically saying, look, very, very skeptical of this. Don't have your hopes up. In fact, many people are saying they don't expect they're going to be able to stop this thing ever.
Wow. Dar, what is something that you would like people to know this week?
I think just to really understand that no matter where you are reading about this information about what's happening, even though you're not, if you may not be directly on the Gulf Coast or in one of these states, even if you are as far away as California, that this situation is so big that it is going to infect everybody. And not just the U.S., but already there's been enough oil and dispersant pumped into the atmosphere, into the water down here, that all of us are going to be breathing this in some parts per million in our air, no matter where we are on the planet at some point. And so we need to all understand how huge this is, that it is affecting all of us, and it's going to affect us all already for generations right now, and it's not stopping. The amount of oil is the same going into the Gulf of Mexico, and they're pumping more dispersants into that oil now than ever before. And this makes for a deadly, toxic soup that is going to affect the Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic Ocean. I've already heard unconfirmed reports that they're testing some tar balls that have washed up on the eastern side, on the eastern coast of Florida. So it's already starting to enter into the Atlantic. So people, I think, I just urge people to pay particularly close attention to this. And, of course, all of this in the context of underscoring the fact of how dire the need is that we get off of this oil economy and onto something that's not going to kill us.
We're actually going to spend the next half of our show talking about wind power. But readers can go, listeners can go to your website, darjamail.org. And read more and stay in touch with what's going on. And also enjoy the photographs of Erica Blumenfeld. Some really good photographs on that site, too. So perhaps we'll talk next week.
Sounds good, Susan. Let's plan on it.
Thank you. That's Dar Jamail in the Gulf of Mexico. Join us again next week for Dar's next update. Meantime, darjamail.org for his regular dispatches and his report on the trip to Ground Zero, as well as photographs by Erica Blumenfeld. That's Moby and Whispering Wind introducing our next segment. The Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area is located in Central California's Diablo Range and is one of the earliest wind farms in the United States. More than 4,900 relatively small wind turbines of various types were installed after the 1970s energy crisis in response to favorable tax policies for investors. Remember those good old days when President Jimmy Carter had solar panels installed on the roof of the White House? Altamont Pass is still the largest concentration of wind turbines in the world, with a capacity of 576 megawatts, producing about 125 megawatts on average and 1.1 terawatt hours yearly. Today, many of these turbines are obsolete and gradually being replaced with much larger and more cost-effective units. The small turbines are also lethal to bird life in the area. Every year, thousands of birds are killed by these turbines, including the birds that are federally protected, like the California golden eagle, the American kestrel, the red-tailed hawk, and burrowing owls. Some of these species are also protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which makes any killing of these birds a violation of federal law. We're going to turn now to Golden Gate Audubon's Conservation Director, Mike Lyons. Okay, it's my great pleasure to welcome Mike Lyons of the Audubon Society. Welcome, Mike. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you are the Conservation Director.
Right, Conservation Director for the Golden Gate Audubon Society, which is an independent chapter of the National Audubon Society.
And the way I ran into you, Mike, was we were at a meeting in which you were talking about the Altamont Pass wind farm. Is that what it's called, the wind farm?
Right. The official name is the Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area, and it is comprised of several wind farms owned and operated by different entities.
Like who? Who are they?
Corporations, and for example, NextEra, which is a subsidiary, I believe, of Florida Power and Light, FPL, is one of the largest holders in the area, and other companies such as Altamont Winds, AES, and Intermexico.
And some of those wind turbines are pretty old, aren't they?
Right. The turbines started going in the late 1970s and early 80s, and some of those are still operating out there now, so they're 20 to 30 years old.
And at this point, they're talking about replacing some of those.
Well, that's certainly the goal. Not everybody is talking about replacing their turbines right now. And it's kind of an ongoing developing process.
And as an Audubon Society director, what's your feeling about these turbines?
Well, the turbines are responsible for a lot of bird mortality every year. One of the most recent estimates was roughly 7,500 to 9,300 birds per year are killed by the turbines in the Altamont. So if you look at that over 20 to 30 years, we're talking about well over 100,000 to 200,000 birds, perhaps more, because now there are fewer turbines currently in operation than there were 20 years ago, because many of them have stopped working. As they break, a lot of times the wind companies don't replace them. They just stop operating them, or they take them down. And also because of some mitigation measures that have been implemented since roughly 2004, many of the turbines have been removed.
And so this is because they're no longer generating the kind of power that's required, or because of the bird controversy?
Well, some of the turbines they've been removing simply because they break down and it's not economical to try to fix them for whatever reason. Others is because of the bird controversy, and Golden Gate Audubon, Santa Clara Valley Audubon, Ohlone Audubon, Mount Diablo Audubon, and Marin Audubon, which are all Bay Area Audubon chapters, have banded together with Californians for Renewable Energy, and we filed a lawsuit, I think it was back in 2004, to challenge the reissuance of permits to several of these wind companies for continued operation of these old turbines. Mm. And we argued that at a minimum, an environmental impact report pursuant to the California Environmental Quality Act had to be conducted in order for them to continue operation, because there was obviously an environmental impact.
So there was never an EIR done in the beginning?
No, there wasn't.
And how did that come about?
To be honest, I don't know. For the most part, there's been a real lack of regulatory oversight at the Altamont for many, many years. And until the Audubon chapters and the Center for Biological Diversity, which had its own initiative and filed its own lawsuit, until those groups stepped up, there was really very little attention paid to this. And so for years, frankly, the Department of Fish and Game, the California Department of Fish and Game, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did nothing about the death of tens of thousands of birds. And it took the litigation of CBD and the Audubon Care lawsuit to really get the ball moving. And unfortunately, the county never really showed a will to make the wind companies do more. So that's what brought the nonprofit groups to the table in trying to, you know, at first challenge the reissuance of the permits and then file their lawsuits.
Mm. And where is that lawsuit at this point?
Center for Biological Diversity lost in the Superior Court, and then they appealed. They had some a pretty good opinion came out of the appellate court, but they still lost their appeal. So their lawsuit, for all intents and purposes, is dead right now. We settled ours in 2006, which and it was ratified by the Alameda County Board of Supervisors in 2007. And in that settlement, we established two major components of the settlement. Well, really three major. The first was it called for the immediate removal of several high-risk turbines. The second was that the wind companies agreed to implement measures to reduce avian mortality by 50% within 3 years of the settlement, so by November 1, 2009. And the last one was that the wind companies would participate in and pay for a natural communities conservation plan or some other kind of comprehensive conservation plan which would contribute or promote to the conservation of the species affected by the wind turbines and would govern operations in the Altamont Pass for many years to come. So we've had this settlement structure that we've been trying to work with for the last, well now, almost 4 years, not without controversy and not without some problems in the settlement. But we've been trying to work through that to make sure that we can get measures that reduce bird mortality.
The first option, you said the first piece that you won of that case was about keeping certain turbines out. What are the characteristics of those turbines?
So some of the turbines in the Altamont Pass are riskier than others. For example, a turbine that's in an area that's more frequented by golden eagles, that's in a particular saddle, a low part of the land where the eagles may swoop through, or that's right close to the edge of a ridge where a lot of birds will come up when they're catching a thermal or an updraft. Those tend to be more dangerous for birds. And so what's happened is the Alameda County established an independent scientific review committee called the SRC. And members of the SRC went out and established risk ratings for several of the turbines. And under the requirements of the SRC, the wind companies are required to remove at least some of those turbines based on the risk rating. Categorizations of risk have sort of changed over time, how they risk it, whether it was a 1 through 3 or a 1 through 10 type of scale. That's been in flux, but it's pretty well established now. My impression from the SRC, from members of the SRC, is that we have a pretty good idea of how to establish whether a turbine is risky, at least for some of the species. Mm-hmm. So we've gotten pretty good, I think, at establishing it, the risk level for things like red-tailed hawks and American kestrels, but not so good for species like the burrowing owl, which mm-hmm. is severely impacted by wind turbine operations.
So I'm thinking now that wind turbines are placed in areas where there's lots of wind, obviously.
Exactly.
So that's also where the birds would be getting the good thermal.
Right. Before there was ever any turbines out there, this was a lot of open grassland, and it attracted a lot of species, like the western burrowing owl, the golden eagle, the red-tailed hawk, the American kestrel, and many, many others, in part because there's great winds out there, and these kind of birds use those winds. It's a major migratory route for a lot of raptors, particularly for golden eagles, and the open grasslands provide abundant food sources for all of those species. Particularly, there's a lot of ground squirrels, and red-tailed hawks and golden eagles love to eat ground squirrels. So it's been always been very attractive to those birds. And then we erected these turbines out there with no environmental considerations and changed the landscape and made it much more dangerous.
Given the situation now with the oil in the Gulf and people beginning again to look at fossil fuels and hopefully come up with better plans, are you seeing that wind turbines are again up for promotion?
They have been for several years. In 2008, Governor Schwarzenegger issued an executive order calling for California's renewable energy portfolio to include to expand, actually 20% of the state's energy was supposed to come by renewable energy, from renewable energy by 2020, I believe. And so there was this big push for new large sources of renewable energy. So there's been no tax breaks. The federal stimulus has contributed to that. President Obama has made it clear that renewable energy is the way forward. And we are cognizant of that. Inside of the environmental community, there's a lot of controversy because all of us are concerned about the effects of climate change and about aggravating climate change by continued reliance on fossil fuels. And you see from the Gulf and other spills just how much that costs, as well as air pollution and all the extraction impacts to the environment. And we know that with climate change, as anticipated, that could affect something like two-thirds of the terrestrial species in North America. It may be alarmist, but there are at least some indications that many, many of those species will have their populations severely diminished, if not be driven to extinction. So we have that on one side. And then we have the problem of how do we develop large-scale renewable energy resources on the other. And when you do that, for example, at a place like the Altamont Pass, you're going to have a significant negative impact on the local population of animals, birds, reptiles, mammals.
End of the migration routes, or the birds on the migration route.
Well, in this
route,
particular
right?
case, right, you're in a migration route, yeah. So it aggravates that problem as well. So you're not just affecting the local population. So the problem that a lot of environmentalists are struggling with, and I think policymakers as well, is that you have this large problem of climate change and this need for renewable energy on one side, and then you have the question of what do you do about the immediate and rather severe impacts on local populations on the other, and how do you balance those out? And so that's why the Audubon chapters that are involved in this case have tried to kind of find a middle ground where we acknowledge the need for renewable energy, and we've said at this point, if they can show us that they can operate Altamont Pass in a responsible way, and there's many measures they need to do, then you know we in the community may need to be ready to accept a certain degree of mortality in the local population. I'm not entirely comfortable with that, to be honest. I go back and forth on it a little bit, and I think it's always, you have to be very mindful that we're dealing with very large corporations, and their bottom line is to make money. And the problem we have as environmentalists is our currency are birds and wildlife and biodiversity. It's not monetized in any way that the companies can really understand. So as we try to find this middle ground, they're talking dollars and kilowatts and cents, and we're talking about, well, what are we giving up by giving up some local birds, or migrating birds for this matter. So it's not an easy path to kind of walk down, but I don't think either extreme is acceptable at this point. Frankly, politically, I don't think that we would, if we advocated to remove all turbines from Altamont Pass, I don't know that we'd ever find the political will to get that done. And so trying to work out a solution that will minimize the impacts, and what our goal through the Natural Communities Conservation Plan, which is part of our settlement, is, it tells the wind companies that if you want to operate wind turbines that hurt birds in the Altamont Pass, in some way, you must contribute to making sure that their populations overall are benefiting from that. And in the end, that comes down to money and mitigation and additional research that will help to protect these species. And at this point, that's the only way we're willing to accept the conservation plan moving forward, is we have to be convinced that overall, so we're going to accept the loss of some local birds, but overall, for example, with golden eagles, something's going to come out of this process which benefits the golden eagle population overall. That's the only way right now that we've really figured out how to go forward.
You're listening to Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore talking to Golden Gate Audubon's Conservation Director, Mike Lines. We air shows like this one each week, as well as archive all our shows for anyone to download. We're pleased to have listeners all over the world, so a shout-out of thanks to listeners in Australia, South Africa, Egypt, India, Norway, Lithuania, Armenia, Turkey, Canada, Alaska, and around the continental United States, and all the other places where you are listening to. Thanks for listening so regularly. We appreciate it. In a recent survey, one of our listeners indicated he listened every week because the host, he said, is, quote, unbought and unbroken, unquote. Thanks for that. as that is exactly what we aim to do, bring honest, down-to-earth voices from around the world and do it in the best way we can, raising topics of concern to people everywhere. Of course, it takes stamina and some funding to do that, and this is where you can help. Consider visiting our website, raisingsandradio.org, or our mothership website, which is a fiscally sponsored organization called Mother Speak, and that's at motherspeak.org, and making a one-time donation, or better yet, a small regular stipend to help us keep afloat. Our website again is raisingsandradio.org. We're a project of Mother Speak and Mother Speak Media, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Go to the website raisingsandradio.org to find our range of progressive topics and download any shows for free. You can also purchase a CD of those shows too. And again, please consider assisting our work of getting the word out by making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio or motherspeak.org. Mother Speak also begins a project we're calling This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. We examine indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the United States, Palestine, and South Africa. We use the lens of industrialization and we focus on what is happening to these people and environments and ask what can be learned from them that can inform more sustainable ways of living and making a living. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the project too. Visit the website, motherspeak.org, to learn how you can contribute your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us. Or you can contact me directly by email at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Now let's go back to Golden Gate Audubon's conservation director, Mike Lyons. I asked Mike how Golden Gate Audubon goes about educating the public about their work and the environmental issues they deal with.
We have our newsletter, we do talks, we talk to the press, and try to inform people to the best of our ability and encourage them to get involved. There's a lot of ways that individual citizens can get involved in processes like this, and they're happening all over. There's a large wind farm that they're talking about putting up in Mendocino County. There's another one in Solano County. There was one that was recently up near Redding. Tehachapi Pass down south is big and getting bigger. By some estimates, it'll be bigger than Altamont Pass in the near future. There's also large solar farms going in various places, and all of these have major impacts on local community groups who are getting involved. So it's coming to the fore. There's no way around it. Whether it's people who are concerned about wildlife impacts or people who just are, they don't want large solar panels in the, you know, area that they used to enjoy having a view of from their window. And that's a new problem that people haven't had to deal with for the most part, you know. So we're just going to have to see how that develops. And really, you know, this is kind of going aside, but there's a lot of talk about, well, should we even be doing these large industrial energy projects? Or should we be diversifying? Should we be putting solar panels on people's homes and small wind power generation inside of cities on top of roofs? And those might have much lower impacts to wildlife instead of finding huge natural areas like the Mojave Desert where they're talking about putting large solar farms, you know, basically paving it over with miles and miles of solar panels. Would it be better to try to figure out a way to put solar panels on every house in Los Angeles? And is that possible? Mm. That's a little beyond what we're doing. You know, we're really focused here on Altamont and some other local wind and solar issues. But right now, it's clear that operations in Altamont, at least for the next 8 to 10 years, are going to continue. And so the question is, how do we do that in a way that minimizes impacts to bird populations if we can actually benefit the species overall?
Now, Mike, I think I recall you saying that there was some decision that had to happen by the end of this month around the wind farms in Altamont Pass.
So that the settlement called for, so if the wind companies did not achieve a reduction in avian mortality by 50% by November 1, 2009, then the parties were supposed to meet and come up with an adaptive management plan that would include measures that would get us to that 50% reduction. The problem with the November 1, 2009 deadline was that we did not have data from the monitoring team, the crew that collects and analyzes the number of mortalities. They collect data and analyze the data on the number of mortalities that are in the Altamont. We didn't have that information in draft form until the middle of December. So we lost our November 1, 2009 deadline. So we were not happy about that, but frankly, there's just nothing we could do. We couldn't make a formal assessment of whether the 50% goal had been met or not. And it wasn't until January 15th, 2010, that the Alameda County's Independent Science Review Committee met to discuss those findings. In any event, in the draft report in 2009, it said the companies had not met the 50% goal. It didn't say how much they'd done, if anything, but it did say they didn't meet the 50%. In January 2010, the Independent Science Review Committee agreed, and they said the wind companies did not achieve the 50% reduction. At least based on the initial data, there was no apparent reduction over the last 3 years of the settlement. Now, the wind companies dispute this. They will dispute it strongly. They have their own experts. They have their own numbers.
But are they sharing the numbers with you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they share their analyses, but they haven't convinced the SRC. And as far as we're concerned, if the SRC is the final arbiter on whether the 50% reduction has been met or not. And the wind companies may disagree on that point as well, but, you know.
As far as you know, did they consult with anyone in groups like the Audubon Society in order to...
The wind companies?
In order to carry out their side of the bargain.
Well, no. We had a problem very early on that, you know, we had measures in the settlement that we did not think were being implemented. We didn't think they were removing some of the turbines in the old towers as quickly as they were supposed to, or at all. And one of the flaws with the settlement, and I will concede, and there have been many critics on both sides about this settlement, that there are numbers of flaws in the settlement itself. It's not a perfect document by any means. Was that there was no mechanism for compliance oversight to make sure the wind companies were doing what they were doing, other than counting on the county, which is unlikely, or counting on Audubon, but there was really no way we could get that information. So in 2008, we entered into mediation with them, and we asserted that they were not complying with the settlement agreement. Mediation took almost a year, and at the end of it, we came up with a new mediation agreement to end mediation, and in that we said, you have to remove additional turbines, do everything you already were supposed to do, you've got to remove some additional turbines now, and you have to pay for a compliance monitor to make sure that in the future you're going to be doing what you say you're going to be doing. And since then, it appears that they have been in compliance with the settlement. So that's good. They've removed the turbines they said they're going to do. They shut them down when they're supposed to shut them down. And at least the information that we have available to us indicates that they've been in compliance since the end of 2008. So that's something. And at least anecdotally, my understanding is the data have started to indicate in the last year or two a decline in the number of birds being killed. But I should say that data collection and data analysis in the Altamont and these estimates of the number of birds being killed is extremely complex, because there's no way that we're going to actually see every bird that gets killed by one of these turbines. And so there's a crew that goes out and they monitor a small subset of all the turbines. And
like
then
every month, every...
Once a month over a set period,
okay,
they visit what we call a number of turbine strings. And that's, I can't frankly tell you exactly how many of the overall turbines, but it's not all of them. Mm-hmm. They're sort of representative and somewhat random in order for it to be scientifically defensible. And they... Then, based on the information they collect, they may find one or two or three or four golden eagles, for example, over a certain period of time. Then they apply all sorts of what they call adjustment factors. And they say, okay, well, if we found, I don't want to just make up numbers here, but if we found 10 golden eagles, that means, well, really 60 golden eagles were killed overall this year. And you can imagine, as soon as you start to inflate numbers like that or estimates like that, all the variables that go into it can be quite controversial, especially when you have people on one side who stand to lose a lot, and that's the wind companies. So they have their own interpretation of this of the data. And it is subject to valid scientific debate. We think that there are members of the SRC are doing a rigorous analysis and that it's defensible. There are times when wind companies disagree, but frankly, that tends to be convenient for them when they disagree. And so it's not very credible to me for the most part. So, but that's one of the open questions about whether they achieved the 50% or not. The wind companies say, you know, we think we did it. We're not conceding that we didn't meet our 50% requirement because there's too much wiggle room in this data. And our position is, look, you know, the monitoring report says you didn't do it. The SRC says you didn't do it. You didn't do it. And so that means you need an adaptive management plan. So when that came out, go back to your original question, when that came out in January, the SRC said, They had not reached their 50% reduction goal. The companies and Audubon started to discuss how to do an adaptive management plan to meet the 50%. Because the companies refused to concede that they had not met the 50%, they didn't really talk to us about real rigorous measures. They put forward what we thought were half measures. So we took what we thought were the recommendations of the SRC about more aggressive removal of turbines, and to the extent that the wind companies want to continue operating, we would say, okay, well, you can take out old turbines, and you can put in new ones, provided they're properly sited. So they're in a place that's not as dangerous to birds as other places, and each one needs to be sited. So that process is called repowering. That's where we take old turbines out and put a new turbine in. And one of these new turbines is anywhere from 10 to 20, maybe almost 30 times stronger and more efficient than the old turbines. So one turbine could conceivably replace anywhere from 10 to 30 old turbines. So right there, you're changing the landscape. You're removing what we call wind walls, these rows and rows of turbines, and you're putting in one in that place. So at least the common sense approach seems to be, well, at least there's going to be fewer turbines for birds to run into. Now, the new turbines are much larger, so they still pose significant risks, but there'll be fewer out there. And it seems all the initial data we have indicate that repowering an area can reduce bird mortality anywhere from 50 to maybe as much as 80%. So that's a huge, huge reduction. So our compromise offer was, look, take out these old turbines now and start the process of repowering. We understand it doesn't happen overnight, but it can start happening in the next year. And it can, if aggressively done, it can be done in 3 to 5 years. The wind companies didn't want to agree to that at all. And
because?
Well, first of all, it's a major investment for them. And there's a lot of risk still in the regulatory environment. Because one of the things about these turbines is they kill birds like the golden eagle. Well, the golden eagle is a fully protected species under California law. There is no legal way for anyone to kill a golden eagle under California state law. When you kill it, you're violating the law. No questions asked. Now, to date, the state attorney general's office and the California Department of Fish and Game have never done anything about those illegal killings. Not anything. The golden eagle is also protected by the U.S. Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which says it's illegal to kill any migratory bird. And again, there's no take permit allowed for that. You can't sign up for a piece of paper that lets you kill them. But again, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Justice have never done anything about that. But it still creates uncertainty for the wind companies. So if they want to put in one of these $1 to $2 million turbines, what's that going to mean if suddenly Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of Fish and Game, starts to enforce these laws against them? So they want some certainty. From an economic standpoint, I can see that. I feel like they've been taking this risk for many years, and they've been making millions and tens of millions of dollars on the process. I think they can live up to the risk now if they want to continue operating. Otherwise, I think they should get out of the Altima.
At some point, they've conceded that turbines need to be shut down at certain parts at certain times of the year, right?
Well, they haven't conceded it. There was a turbine shutdown requirement in the permits that were reissued to them back in 2004, and that was also echoed in our settlement agreement to make sure that that was reinforced. We didn't want to backtrack off some of the protections that were in those permits in our settlement agreement. Though arguably, one of the problems with our settlement agreement is it didn't require them to do an environmental impact report right away. And that's a much longer story, but that's probably one of the problems with the agreement. So they do shut them down from November through February of each year. And
that's because of the migration.
Well, that was one of the times of year where they had lowest wind production, and for some species they had very high mortality. At least that was the indication.
Okay.
So it seemed like a good match. Like if you're going to shut them down to reduce mortality, doing it in these months was the way to do it. There's been some questions about how that was implemented overall in the early years, but at least in the last 2 to 3 years they've been doing it right for the most part. And it seems like they've complied with that. Now, there's some question as to whether that's how effective that's been, but I think the conventional wisdom is that it definitely saves some birds' lives.
A reminder that this is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore talking with Golden Gate Audubon's Conservation Director, Mike Lyons. I suggested that Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area offers a classic example of differences between the needs of the natural environment and what corporations believe is their need for profit.
Well, certainly a difference in priorities. If you ask the wind companies, they would tell you they're very concerned about the environment, they're in renewable energy development, you know, they're kind of on that climate change side of things. But when it comes down to it, they're businesses. And so all the numbers have to line up for them, and they basically, at the end of the day, have to make a suitable profit. And that is what causes the continual conflict. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really no different than an oil company cutting corners on an oil rig in order to maximize profit and then potentially putting the environment at risk. And so it's a larger problem with corporate development or development in general and what environmentalists have to deal with, and that's the externalization of costs that corporations generate as they're trying to seek profit. So in a nutshell, it's to the benefit of the corporation to externalize costs to the fullest extent possible. It doesn't want to pay for dead birds or conservation of dead birds. It doesn't want to pay to restore habitat that it may destroy in doing what it does. And it's basically the job of the environmental nonprofits that are challenging them to make them internalize those costs. So that either is a forcing them to take more expensive measures, take more measures which are more expensive, or to reduce electrical capacity, or to pay into a conservation fund. And how I look at it is, it's kind of like, you know, we're all taught from little kids to clean up after ourselves and to take care of our own messes. And corporations don't behave that way unless forced to, either by law or because citizens step up and make them do it.
You're indicating that there's a lot of power being generated here, millions of dollars worth of profit. Does it enter the state grid, or how does it get used?
My understanding is they sell to PG&E, and then PG&E distributes the power.
Okay.
And beyond that, honestly, I don't really know. They have very complicated contracts with PG&E, which, you know, is essentially a monopoly.
Yeah.
So
what has been the most challenging and interesting, you know, vitalizing aspect of this work for you?
I find that the science and the biology of it fascinating, and I learned a lot more about the species like golden eagles and western boring owls and what they need, not only in the Altamont Pass, but throughout their ranges. So as a bird nerd, I find all that stuff very fascinating itself, unto itself. And then overall, this kind of challenge of how do we balance, on the one side, the need to develop renewable energy versus how do we do that responsibly so that we don't have such significant local impacts that we drive local populations to extinction, or at least extirpation. Mm-hmm. And we haven't found that right balance yet. I don't know that anybody has. And I don't know that anybody ever will. Every side is open to criticism on whether you err on one side or the other. But I definitely think, you know, it's highlighted to me this responsibility we have to protect and conserve local populations of birds. Because in the end, each of us needs to step up to do that. Otherwise, globally or throughout the birds' range, we're going to lose them. Mm. And so
I recently did an interview with Suzanne Stone of the Defenders of Wildlife up in Montana, the western region up there, and she's a conservationist for wolves. There's a thing going on there now with they're again trying to educate the farmers, the ranchers about the wolves, because there's the court case going on about whether they can start shooting wolves again, which has until recently been endangered, right? She said that one of the things that she noticed was that with the reintroduction of wolves, in fact, the whole ecology, the wildlife ecology of the area changes and improves, that wolves, contrary to how they've been presented, are actually so intrinsic to keeping that ecology healthy, and even the plants, everything starts to respond in a different way when the wolves are reintroduced. Do you think that's true of the bird life out in the Altamont Pass also?
Well, I think that's true any time that humans have come in and change the ecology of an area. You know, a classic example is in Point Reyes, for example, where they have mule deer and deer that are over-browsing in some areas because they have no natural predators. And in the Altamont Pass, it's a significantly altered landscape because of ranching primarily. So they've come through and all those grasses are exotic, for example. And then you add the wind turbines on top of it and you have significant impacts there. And then also the removal of native predators, like large mammals in the area and things like that. So the whole ecosystem out there is kind of out of whack. Mm-hmm. But one of the great things about birds is that they are perhaps one of the most adaptable taxa group of animals. And I think in many ways they've adapted to some of those changes out there, and that's actually been a problem. So you have a rolling landscape of grasslands, which is great for open space hunters like eagles or red-tailed hawks. But these turbines, even when they're not running, create perches. And that may be what's killing a lot of burrowing owls, is it allows a larger raptor to perch on top of one of these turbines and look at the burrowing owl colony and start picking them off. Mm. It would be fascinating, frankly, to see the area without turbines and to see how it would change. It would have to be more than just, you know, when you have a mesopredator, like a large predator, like a wolf, there's so much sort of below it that gets affected by its presence. That I don't know that if you took the turbines out without, you know, doing more large mammal restoration or whatever, how much more you would see. I think you'd certainly see a lot more birds out there, and that would be something.
So you alluded to the grass out there now all being exotic. Does that mean that their ranches and cattle are also in and out of the areas where the wind turbines are?
Oh yeah, almost all of the land, particularly in Alameda County, is on which turbines are, is privately held land, which is ranched, and there are cattle out there all the time. And they lease the footprint of the turbines and access to the wind companies. So it's a pretty big money operation. So those ranchers make a fair bit of money on those leases.
Yeah. And could this be why there was no EIR, environmental impact reports, done?
Because it's on ranch land?
Because it's on private land.
Well, that may have been the rationale. If it had been just on state land, they maybe wouldn't have tried the game. But they didn't do an EIR because they didn't want to do an EIR. Because an EIR would be expensive. It would require them to minimize to the greatest extent practicable. And it would require mitigations.
But if the state had been involved, perhaps there would have been more pressure to do that. Or is that incorrect?
Sure, if it had been on any kind of public land.
Yeah.
It would have been more clear-cut. You know, it's clear, I think everybody concedes that there's no way that those operations can continue without an EIR. As a matter of fact, they're preparing an EIR now, at least maybe two EIRs. And there's other, you know, repowering projects going forward right now as well for which EIRs are being prepared.
And I don't want to be a cynic here, but my experience with EIRs is often there's a lot of work done, in fact, so much work done that you barely have enough time to go through them. It's almost this avalanche of information
that comes
at you.
What I was doing today when you came. I have a 10,000-page document that I'm trying to comment on.
And so they're also kind of used as a way to, you know, comply, but in a kind of passive-aggressive way.
Yeah. Oh, undoubtedly. Most EIRs are of fairly dubious value because it's usually prepared by a consultant who's paid by a company to reach a conclusion the company wants to get. And I will hear no end of hell from some consultants I know for saying that. I'm pretty cynical about that process overall. But what it does do is it makes them lay their cards on the table. And if they don't do a good enough job, it at least exposes them to challenge by people who do know. And there's enough people watching the Altamont Pass now, there's us, there's many others, that I think if they try to get by with a shoddy EIR, they're going to get challenged on it. And when they get challenged and they hold up the EIR, that costs a lot of money, even if they eventually prevail, because it holds up their whole project. And these guys, you know, this is part of the bigger issue, is they're moving fast all over the country. I mean, they feel like, well, you know what, if we can't do it here in the Altamont, we'll just go do it in Texas or Nebraska or Maine or wherever else they want to operate. And so they're under a lot of really hard pressures to move quick and to move their money around and turn it over.
And probably at this point there's a lot of support, as I say, because of the Gulf, to move things along quickly rather than take the time to really figure
out. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there's... Well, there's already been efforts in California to reduce environmental review on some major renewable projects. It hasn't really gone very far, but there's sort of been whispers that they want to do that. And that will be met with extreme opposition from most of the environmental community.
Mike, here on Raising Sand Radio, we're always trying to get people more engaged in the process. And how can they get engaged more in this particular topic or the process in general of maintaining our environment?
Well, in the Altamont Pass specifically, I think that the couple of the best ways to get involved are to start learning more about the specifics of the project, whether it's reading newspaper articles or going to our website or contacting us or others that are involved and trying to find out more information there. And then look for opportunities.
And your website is?
www.goldengateaudubon.org. The next stage is to look for opportunities to get involved as a member of the public. So, for example, as new EIRs come up for repowering projects, for continued operations out there, or permits come up for additional review, those are all open to public comment and even public challenge. I mean, an individual citizen can come out of his house, go to the hearing, and challenge it. And if he doesn't like the result, he can appeal it. If he doesn't like that, he can go to court. It doesn't take a group like Audubon to do it. Anybody can do it. And there's stakeholder groups that have formed and gotten together and work on these issues. And so those are all ways to immediately get involved on this. And this is something that's going to go on throughout the state for many years to come. That sort of same application of interest and skills and commitment really can apply to any environmental issue that someone might take an interest in. So, for example, there's been discussion of development at the Hunters Point and the Candlestick Point shipyard in San Francisco, and the EIR just came out. And so, that's an issue I'm working on right now. That's a really big issue. It's very complicated. It takes many years to get involved in and try to do anything about. But there's smaller things that pop up all the time, whether it's the conversion of a local grass park to artificial turf for playing fields. And if that bothers you or you're concerned about it, you can go talk to the planning people or go to the hearings and comment. Or local regional planning, like general plans, that's all open to the public to come in and provide comments about what they want. And we at the Audubon Society, we have a paid staff that comes here every day, and there's six or seven of us that work in this particular office. But for the most part, our group, Golden Gate Audubon, and most Audubon chapters are really driven by individual members who come in and volunteer their time because a particular issue concerns them. And that's where the Audubon group came from, really, was individuals getting together, pooling their resources and their knowledge and their skills to try to affect change to promote conservation. And that's still what it is today. The strongest moves that we at Golden Gate Audubon make are because one of our volunteers has taken a lead on some particular issue.
So that's www.goldengateaudubon.org.
Yes.
And people can get in touch with you directly through there too?
Yes.
That was Golden Gate Audubon's Conservation Director, Mike Lyons. And again, you can visit their website or go to our website and get a link to it. We're going to go out today with Pete Seeger and Bruce Springsteen, doing the piece at Barack Obama's inauguration. Ah, remember the days when hope was high and change was just around the corner?
This land was made for you and me. This land is yours. Yeah.